And in this lecture, what we're interested in discussing is if we add a new particle into our Lagrangian, say, we supplement the standard model with something, how do we predict its abundance in the universe at the time of the CMB? Because that's the time where we measure the dark matter abundance. So we need to map somehow the particle physics theory into some kind of cosmological quantity. So the main topic of today is going to be abundances in the early universe. And to do that, we need to basically have a mapping between a particle physics theory and an abundance at times that are before comparable to the time of the CMB. And now, in order to do this, we'll take a bottom-up approach to motivate this, which is what do we see now? And how can we extrapolate that to what we expect to have in the early universe? So the two clues that we have are as follows. One of them is just the existence of the cosmic microwave background. This is something yesterday we talked about the anisotropies, about the fact that there were small deviations, and you could look for sound waves in those deviations, and that tells you something about the relative content. But the anisotropies are very small. They're of the order of 1 part in 10 to the 5. And if you just plot the spectrum, so the intensity of the photons versus the frequency, then you get the usual black body spectrum. So what this tells us is that photons were a thermal ensemble in the early universe. Because if they weren't thermal, they wouldn't give us something that looks thermal now. So this suggests that at some time, well, today, photons continue to be in a thermal bath. And so what we can do is rewind the clock and see what happened at earlier times. And so to do that, we use the second fact, which is that we observe that the universe is expanding. So there's a Hubble expansion. And the characteristic time that we see for the Hubble expansion is about 10 inverse gigayears, or 10 gigayears all inverse, which is about the age of the universe. So we know that the universe, as we go to later and later times, is getting bigger and bigger. So if we go the opposite direction, then, of course, in the early universe, was smaller. And in particular, smaller distance scales mean that wavelengths of photons are getting blue shifted. So right now, the photons are quite cold. The temperature of this ensemble is about 3 Kelvin, which is about 10 to the minus 4 EV or so, something like that, 10 to the minus 3 EV. But we can imagine the universe is getting smaller and smaller and as we go earlier in time. And so all of the wavelengths were getting contracted. So what this means is that earlier times corresponded to more energy and therefore higher temperature for the photons. And at sufficiently high temperature, you start having new processes that turn on. So for instance, we know that you can have photons that annihilate into E plus E minus. And there's a kinematic threshold associated with this, which is that the energies of these photons have to be enough that you can put the energy into the mass of the electrons. So this turns on at a T larger than, say, the mass of the electron. So as we go to smaller scales and higher temperatures for the photons, eventually you start creating electrons, and you get electrons in the thermal bath as well. So now we have a thermodynamic system with multiple species in it. We have electrons and photons. And then as we go even to earlier and earlier times, so for instance, T gamma larger than, say, the top quark mass, then we find that all standard model particles are in the thermal bath. So what this tells us is that what we need to do is to take into account both the expansion of the universe and what's happening with the thermodynamics of these particles in the expanding universe background. Okay? And so the topics that we're going to cover today First, I'll give a review of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, which is our description of the background for an expanding spacetime. And this will establish the key parameters for the expansion. Then we'll talk about what the thermodynamics look like in equilibrium. So this will allow us to say, take the temperature of the photon bath and say, given this temperature, how many photons do we have? How many electrons? How many top quarks? How many of everything else? That also, if we add in some new dark matter particle, will allow us to say how many dark matter particles we have at a particular time in thermal equilibrium. And then we'll see what happens when we take these thermodynamic principles and apply the expansion to them. Okay. So any questions about the setup for what we're doing? Oh, okay. So we'll start with the FRW universe. So the initial starting point for the derivation of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric is homogeneity and isotropy. What this means is that space has a uniform density of stuff that's inside of the universe, and that it looks the same in all directions. And this initially just started out as an assumption to make the calculation simpler. But what we find is the CMB, again, looks very isotropic. And because it comes from light propagating in all directions, the fact that it's isotropic also means that the universe is probably very homogeneous as well. So even though this started out as just a way of actually calculating something, it turns out to be very consistent with what we observe. And so if we make these assumptions, then there's basically one form of the metric that we can write down, which is ds squared is dt squared minus a squared times the spatial metric. Here I'm just using the particle physics metric convention because we'll use that elsewhere. We're not going to do too much with the actual metric, so you can choose to flip the signs if you want to. For this three-dimensional metric to be homogeneous and isotropic, it has a very specific form, which is it can be written in a spherical coordinate system. So k is the curvature of the space. If k is 0, this is just a flat three-dimensional spatial metric. And so what this metric is doing is it's the same metric, except the spatial coordinates are all being dilated by this factor of a as a function of time. So a is, in some sense, set to the ruler size for the universe. And so in an expanding universe, a is getting bigger as a function of time. And a of t is called the scale factor. Now, for our purposes, a of t itself is a little bit of an arbitrary function because I can change my definition of what space, what time various things are happening. So the thing that actually matters to us is how quickly the universe is expanding, because that tells us how quickly, say, the temperatures of the different ensembles are changing. So the change in scale factor, which is the expansion rate, it's called the Hubble scale. And it's defined as a dot of t over a of t. So we see that for things that rely on Hubble, overall normalizations or changes in the scale factor don't matter. It's just the ratio of how fast it's changing relative to the size itself. So in some sense, you can think of, so Hubble has dimensions of derivative of time. Okay? So it has dimensions of 1 over time. You can think of inverse Hubble as the time it takes for the universe to double in size, essentially. And so that tells you approximately how quickly the universe is expanding. And that's why in the current universe, if we measure Hubble to be about an inverse 10 billion years, it means the universe is about 10 billion years old. Okay. So this is the form of the metric, but we actually want to figure out how the metric changes, and in particular in response to the matter that's inside of the universe. And this, of course, comes from Einstein's equations. So this basically gives the solution of A of t as a function of things like the energy density in the universe. And the form of Einstein's equations, if you remember, looks something like this. G mu nu is equal to 8 pi g t mu nu. Because we're in natural units, g is basically 1 over m Planck squared. Okay. And so what Einstein's equation tell us is this Einstein tensor on the left is formed from derivatives of the metric. So this is how the space-time is evolving. And on the right, what we have is the energy density of stuff that's in the universe. So we see that the scale factor on the left is going to be evolving as a function of whatever the energy is in things on the right. So we have our metric. So in principle, we can compute the left-hand side of this. And what this gives us is some set of, you know, derivatives of A. And so what we need are the t mu nu, so what the energy density of the universe is. And now this is, in principle, an arbitrary four-dimensional tensor. However, what we have to do is we have to make sure that our expression for t mu nu respects the assumptions we made in deriving this metric. Because if t mu nu doesn't respect those symmetries, then we don't expect the metric to obey those symmetries either. So in particular, we started out assuming that the metric is homogeneous and isotropic. And so our t mu nu had better also be homogeneous and isotropic. Otherwise, it will induce corrections to the metric that violate this condition. So the most general form, so if we add in the homogeneity and the isotropy condition, has this form. There's a rho, which is the total energy density, and then minus p, minus p, minus p along the diagonal, which is the pressure of whatever the matter is. So we're basically treating matter as some kind of a fluid. And these are suggestive symbols of that. But really, this is the only thing that you can write down that is consistent with homogeneity and isotropy. Because if I put in any off-diagonal elements, then I'm picking out very specific directions in space. The homogeneity requirement, again, requires that all of these things be constant in space. The one thing we're allowed to have different is time, because things are changing as a function of time. And what turns out to be true is that the relationship between rho and p is determined by what kind of matter you have. Or I should be more careful and say what kind of stuff you have. So in other words, if I have, let's see, I have a question. Yes. So. You flip the sign. Yeah. I think it also depends on whether it's upstairs or downstairs. So I may have mixed it up, but yeah. So the key thing is that rho and p, according to this definition, have opposite signs. But of course, I haven't told you what p as a function of rho is. So p, you know, once again, this is up to some redefinition that you can do. But the convention is that the signs are opposite. So for instance, if I have non-relativistic matter, that is matter whose dominant energy is in the mass, then you can just kind of see intuitively that p is going to be equal to zero. You can think about this from kinetic theory that you know, pressure is, in some sense, the kinetic energy that's contained within the fluid. And so if things are nearly at rest, then rho is the dominant component. And that's basically just saying that most of the energy is just stuff that's sitting there. So that's one of them. We call these, by the way, equations of states. And depending on the relationship between P and rho, I'm going to get different solutions to my Einstein equations. So this is one possibility. The other possibility is that matter is relativistic. In this case, what we have is P equals rho over 3. And again, I'm not going to derive this. You probably derived it in some statistical mechanics class, that the pressure of a gas, an ideal gas, is a third of the energy density. But it sort of relates to the fact that the pressure gets distributed among surfaces in three dimensions, and so the energy density roughly gets cut by a factor of 3. The last possibility is vacuum energy. And this is what happens when you have P is equal to minus rho. So you see, if I put P equals minus rho into this matrix, I get just a diagonal matrix. Okay. And does anyone remember what happens if I have, say, a contribution in the Einstein equation that's just proportional to the diagonal matrix? Did you talk about this in GR at all? Yeah. So in this case, it's just a metric. It's a cosmological constant. Okay. And this just comes from the fact that you're basically adding a trivial term in your action. Okay. And when you do the equations of motion, you just get an extra additive thing that's proportional to the identity. Okay. So this is basically a cosmological constant, which we talked about yesterday as being related to vacuum energy. So we see that we can accommodate the three different kinds of matter that we see in our universe. There's relativistic matter, which is the CMB photons. There's a non-relativistic matter, which is like dark matter or baryons. And then there's a vacuum energy component. And how each of these change the evolution of the metric, you can just find by plugging in the particular values. Can people still see if I write here, or should I move already? Good, okay. I'll draw a line here so I don't move too far over. Okay, so if I take ds squared and plug it into the Einstein equation, I essentially end up with two independent equations. You can rewrite them in different ways. One of them has the form rho dot plus 3h rho plus p equals 0. And this is often referred to as the continuity equation. The reason is that this is not really determining how the expansion is operating. It says, given a particular Hubble constant, this is how the energy density gets diluted. So the energy density changes by a factor that's proportional to the expansion. So this one is more saying how matter responds to the expansion. Okay. The second equation is h squared plus k over a squared, where k is this curvature, is 8 pi g over 3 rho. So this is an equation where I can just plug in something for rho and solve for a explicitly. Now, what we are going to do from now on is we're going to assume that k is equal to 0. The reason for this is that the CMB measurements and various other measurements seem to point towards us living in a flat universe. Okay? So everything that we're going to derive is going to be in a flat universe. Of course, if you want to, you can go and make k non-zero and rederive all the equations. But that just moderately changes things. Okay. So if k is equal to 0, what we get is a very concrete relationship between the energy that's in some amount of matter and the expansion. So what we define is rho, if we solve this equation, well, I just rearranged this. I'm going to define this as 3h squared over 8 pi g. So in order for k to be 0, the sum of all of my different rho components has to satisfy this equation. Otherwise, it's not consistent with k being 0. So this gives me some relationship between the total amount of stuff that's in my universe and the Hubble scale. So why is that useful? It's useful because I now have a useful benchmark for saying what the total amount of energy in the universe is. So in particular, I can say, well, if my total energy density has to be this rho critical, then the sum of my rho I's and various components of, say, matter, radiation, cosmological constant, has to sum up to rho critical. So this allows me to define some fraction omega I, which is rho I over rho critical. And what this is the fraction of energy that is in a particular component. And this is the omega that I was talking about yesterday that I kind of used it without defining, but we said omega baryon is 5%. So this means that the amount of energy in baryons over the critical density is 0.05. And then, of course, the sum of these things is 1. So for our purposes, we don't actually really need to know how to solve the Friedmann equations. What's just relevant is what comes out of the Friedmann equations. And in particular, when you solve these equations, what you find is that the energy density of radiation has a proportionality of scale factor to the minus fourth. The matter, so this just comes from plugging in the different p equals rho or a third rho, 0 or minus 1. This scales like a to the minus third. And rho vacuum, as you might not be surprised to see, is just a constant. So once again, we can play our game and say, well, as I go to earlier and earlier times, the scale factor is getting smaller. And so the vacuum energy density stays the same. The matter energy density is getting bigger by a factor of a to the minus 3. And radiation is getting bigger even faster by a factor of a to the minus 4. So in the early universe, you always get radiation dominated, meaning that the radiation component is growing the fastest. And what we really just mean here is that if we sort of take as a function of time, here's rho, the vacuum energy contribution is going to be constant. We're going to get some, say, increasing function of rho matter. But then the radiation is going to grow even faster than that. So in the very early universe, we can just make the assumption that most of the matter was in radiation. And this sort of agrees with our intuition here that as we crank up the temperature to temperatures much bigger than the mass of all the standard model particles, all the standard model particles become relativistic as well. Right? So we expect there to be a lot of energy in radiation. So as a result, we, for all the results that we'll write down after this point, everything will be in a radiation-dominated universe. And in particular, I can just write an explicit expression down for the Hubble scale. So the Hubble is equal to 1 over 2 times time. And this is going to be proportional to 1 over a squared. So what this tells us is that a of t is some constant times square root of t. And this will be important later as we try to connect the various energy scales or the expansion scales with how they evolve as a function of time. So just to recap what we've done so far, we started with the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy, and we solved the Einstein equations. And what we ended up with was a solution for the scale factor as a function of time. So this tells us now how the universe is expanding. So are there any questions about what we've done so far?
I didn't get past the last, was what era was that?
This is all radiation dominated. And everything that we'll do is in the radiation dominated era. And it turns out that where the crossing point between radiation and matter happened was around the CMB time. So, yeah.
It's kind of asking the three curves in each, right?
Yeah, sorry, this was a bad drawing. Let me do this. Yeah. There's not necessarily a triple point yet. Oh, any other questions about the expansion history? Okay, so let's move on to thermodynamics. So now that we know what the background is, we can ask ourselves, given a particular temperature T, what does the thermal bath look like? So we expect that we're going to go from just photons to including various other particles in the standard model, but we want to derive this. Okay. And we're first going to derive it in thermal equilibrium. So this is basically just a statistical mechanics like you did probably in an undergraduate course. And the first thing that we have to do is actually define what we mean by equilibrium. And this is a bit tricky because conventionally, we often think about equilibrium as meaning that things aren't changing, so things have reached some kind of steady state. And so that basically translates into some condition that for any function of time, df by dt is equal to zero. And so this is usually the starting point for statistical mechanics. But of course, we're now operating in this expanding space-time background. We see that H, which is A dot over A, is most definitely not zero. So we have some things that are changing as a function of time. And so strictly speaking, in terms of how you define equilibrium, say in a stat-mech course, you can't make the assumption of equilibrium because there's something that's just inherently changing. But of course, this is true even for the processes you considered in your stat-mech course, that there's this expanding universe. And so why didn't you have to care about the expanding universe? The reason is that the expanding universe is expanding so slowly that all of the things that are happening in the lab are on timescales much faster than that. So the criterion for allowing some kind of equilibrium is that, so equilibrium is defined by this condition f dot is equal to zero on time scales delta t much, much smaller than the expansion rate of the universe. So if we do this, then we can essentially neglect the expansion. We do thermodynamics the usual way that we do in this sort of quasi-steady state approximation. And then we go in later and sort of input the expansion as a background effect. And provided all the timescales are much shorter than Hubble, that any sort of back reaction associated with that is going to be negligible. And so the general condition for equilibrium is we have equilibrium if gamma, which are all rates, associated with, say, a particular process are much bigger than Hubble. This is just the inverse statement of this. Okay, so so now we can just do normal statistical mechanics. And because we're doing quantum field theory, where you have particle numbers that can change, we have to use the grand canonical ensemble. And in stat-mech, what you do is you define some kind of distribution that gives the phase space associated with the different quantities, thermodynamic quantities, associated with the particle. And so this distribution function is defined f. And it's usually a function of the whole phase space, so of both position and momentum. This I is going to label the species I. So it could be a photon, it could be electron, it could be dark matter, it could be whatever we want. Okay. Now we're going to kind of flip back and forth between our equilibrium thermodynamics picture and the expansion picture, in particular, because this is in general quite a complicated function. But just like when we were deriving the Einstein equations, we needed an energy momentum tensor that was consistent with the symmetries. Because we know that our background is homogeneous and isotropic, then that also had better be true for these distribution functions. For the same reason that if the distribution functions were not homogeneous and isotropic, it would induce some inhomogeneities in my metric. So I'll put the exact same condition of homogeneity and isotropy. So this means that I basically can't have a dependence on X, because otherwise I would have special places in the universe that were different. And it also means that I can't have a dependence on the full momentum. I can only have a dependence on the magnitude of the momentum, again, because I don't want to pick out a specific direction. So this basically reduces to a distribution function of the energy of the particle, which is, of course, just p squared plus mi squared. And this just has the usual form, e to the power of e minus mu I over ti minus plus 1. And if you remember, this is for bosons, and this is for fermions. And we're going to keep this convention throughout, that the bosons go on top for the sign and the fermions go on the bottom. So this ensemble is characterized by two quantities for each species. There's the Ti, and this is, of course, the temperature. And this is the mean kinetic energy of the species. The other thing is the chemical potential. And this, in some sense, characterizes particle number. But we actually have to be a little bit careful here, because what we don't mean by particle number is just the number of, say, excitations of this field that are in the thermal bath. It turns out that this mu I characterizes the difference between the number of species I and the number of species I bar, which is the antiparticle associated with it. Okay. And you can kind of think of this where in statistical mechanics you had you could change, say, the number of particles inside of what you were calling your thermal bath. So we consider that particle numbers, that processes that say create particles and antiparticles, are still just creating things within the thermal bath. Right? Whereas changing the relative numbers is actually modifying the net number of these things. And once you write down the expressions for what the number densities of these particles look like, you can explicitly show that mu is proportional to this. I'm not going to show it, but you can just take my word for it that mu actually corresponds to asymmetries, the number densities of particles. Now, if we actually look around us and say, what is matter-antimatter asymmetric? One thing that is matter-antimatter asymmetric is baryons. There are more, say, protons than antiprotons. And even though it looks like there are a lot of protons, as in everything that we see is made of protons, the actual size of this asymmetry, so the number density of baryons minus antibaryons, I'll just write out explicitly, over, say, the number of photons, which goes like this mu b over t, this is an order 10 to the minus 9 or so. So what this means is that even though everything we see is made up of baryons and not antibaryons, this was actually a very tiny fraction of the total number of baryons in the early universe. And so what this means is that we're always going to set mu equal to 0 in everything that we do. Just because observationally we see that asymmetries between particles and antiparticles tend to be quite small. Once again, you can go and rederive everything in this case, and depending on your early universe cosmology, you might have to do that, but for the basic picture, you don't have to do that. Okay, so we've now essentially reduced all of the thermodynamics to this single number, which is the temperature, which characterizes the bath. And we can, in principle, have a different temperature for each species. Okay. So we can then compute the number of particles and the energy in each species. And these basically come from taking this distribution function, integrating it over your phase space. So for instance, the number of particles I as a function of temperature is going to be GI. So this is the number of degrees of freedom, which is a usual prefactor in statistical mechanics. So in the case of particle physics, it's usually going to be the number of spin degrees of freedom. So fermions have two, because there are two spins. A scalar has zero, a vector that's massive has three, that sort of thing. And then we take an integral over all of the momenta. And just integrate over this distribution function. This is the number density. Similarly, we can take the energy density as a function of temperature, and it's the same thing, except because we want an average energy, we're just going to weight this integral by energy. This is E function of P, Fi function of P. Okay, so this is a number per unit volume, and you can see that from the fact that it has dimensions of energy to the 3, or length to the minus 3. This is energy per unit volume, and it has dimensions of 4 in terms of mass units. So what this allows us to do is, given the temperature of the thermal bath, we can now compute the number of each species at that temperature. So are there any questions about the stuff we've done so far for the thermodynamics? Okay, so I'm now just going to write down a few extra formulas that are going to be handy, which are basically these integrals evaluated in certain limits. Okay. So first, we're going to take the relativistic limit. So this is going to be this radiation component, where was it? P equals 0. And when I do that, I find that my integrals take a very simple form. So the number density looks like this. So once again, the top number is for bosons. The bottom number is for fermions. So this times GI, some numerical coefficients over the temperature times the temperature cubed. And this energy density is going to be the same thing. There's a different coefficient. And this is for T much bigger than M. Now, in some ways, we could have guessed the general form of this just from dimensional analysis, which is that we have a dimensional scale, the temperature. And if the mass is negligible, then the only thing that this dimension 3 object can depend on is the temperature. So it tells me it goes like T cubed. Similarly, the energy density can only go like T to the fourth. And so this gives a very simple relationship for number densities and energy densities for radiation. And as we saw, the universe is mostly made up of radiation. So this is a very useful set of equations to have. Of course, the opposite of this is the non-relativistic limit. And this is for temperatures that are much smaller than the mass. So what we find are is this dependence. So this one's a bit trickier to guess because we have two energy scales in the problem. But there's one factor which should look familiar, which is this exponential. So we see that the number density goes like some power of mass and temperature times e to the minus m over t. Okay. This is just a Boltzmann factor. So we know in classical statistical mechanics that you weight the different probabilities of finding, say, a particle in a certain state by e to the minus energy over temperature. And because temperature is much smaller than mass, this ends up being a small number. Okay. So what this tells us is that in thermal equilibrium, as the temperature cools below the mass of a particular particle, its abundance starts being depleted exponentially. And this is just the finding that if I have, say, this particle I, there are two directions that the process can go in. I can have photons creating II bar, and I can have II bar annihilating to photons. This process always happens because kinematically photons are massless, and so I can always do this. However, this relies on the energy in these photons being bigger than the mass of this particle. And so, of course, if the temperature of this photon bath gets below the mass of the particle, you're relying on very rare fluctuations in the photon bath to produce these particles. And so what happens is that this process happens, this process stops, and you just have a steady depletion of the number density of this particle. And that's why you have this exponential factor. For rho, it basically, you get something that's very similar, except there's an additional factor of mass to make the dimensions work out. Okay. So this basically characterizes all the different kinds of abundances that we can have in the early universe. And notice that I haven't actually said anything about the expanding universe yet. I've basically just used the symmetries of the FRW universe to motivate a particular form of these distribution functions. Okay. So the last thing that we're going to do before we actually talk about how these change with the expansion is to define some useful quantities. Okay. So because the universe is radiation dominated, the total energy in radiation is much bigger than everything else. And so this is a quantity that we are interested in. So what we do is we define that the energy density in radiation has this form, pi squared over 30 g star t gamma to the fourth. And notice that this has a very similar form to the energy that's inside of radiation in the relativistic limit. Okay? But what this g star is this is the energy for a particular species. The g star is basically summing over all of the species that contribute to radiation. And we express it just in terms of the temperature T gamma, the reason being that if you're in thermal equilibrium with photons, we know what the temperature of the photons is now, so photons form some kind of useful ruler that we can compare everything against. So T gamma is just the sort of standard ruler from the fact that we have some measurement of it now. And G star is defined like this. It's the sum over bosons of Gi Ti over T gamma to the fourth times the theta function plus sum over fermions, Gi, Ti over T gamma to the fourth times 7/8 times this theta function. So this basically just is saying, okay, the particle is relativistic if the temperature is bigger than the mass, and then it contributes equal to the coefficient of the radiation energy density for that species. And so this is called the effective number of relativistic species and you can just think of it as some overall scaling of the single particle result to the total energy that's in the radiation bath. Once again, this is more just out of convenience because of the fact that the total radiation is driving the expansion at early times, and so instead of carrying around lots of different temperatures, we just carry around one temperature and this G star. We sort of hide all of the mess of the different temperatures inside of G star. Okay. Okay. So, are there any questions about the second part of the thermodynamics that we discussed, Tipra?
So, so different species have different temperature.
In principle.
In principle, and even though they're interacting with the photon.
That's right. So I mean, this expression is a bit more general than everything being in thermal equilibrium. This is, if you have a bunch of things that are in thermal equilibrium within themselves, but they may not all be in thermal equilibrium together. If they're all in thermal equilibrium together, then the temperatures would be equal across everything. This is just for things that are in thermal equilibrium with something, okay, in some sense. With themselves, they have a thermal spectrum is really what it means, that this Fi is a thermal one. But that's a good question. Any other questions? Okay, so the last thing that we want to do today is tie in what we've seen with the expanding universe and thermodynamics to have some kind of unified picture. And perhaps not surprisingly, what will turn out to be the link is that the thermodynamics depended on the temperature T, and the expansion depended on the scale factor A. And so what we really want to do is link this temperature to the scale factor and see how it changes. Once we have that, then we can just change the temperature in our thermodynamic ensembles, and that tells us the abundances at all times. So we want thermo in the expanding background. And to do this, we basically want to know, you know, T has some proportionality to A, essentially. So one thing that we can do is we can take the radiation-dominated expressions and just plug them into the Friedmann equations, and that will explicitly relate T and the scale factor. It turns out, though, that that's somewhat specific to the particular number of species and things that we have, so we'll make a more general argument. Okay. And this argument is based on entropy conservation. Okay. So use entropy to determine this. And the way that we can do this is that we can write down what's effectively the second law of thermodynamics. I mean, it's really the combination of the first and second law. We know that du is T ds minus P dv. And in this context, I'm going to look at some co-moving volume. So v is equal to A cubed. So basically, I'm considering a volume that expands with the size of the universe. And what I want to see is how the entropy changes. And what we'll find is that the entropy is actually conserved. And this gives us a very concrete link between these different quantities. Okay. So du is the total energy. Of course, the energy is just going to be energy per unit volume times the volume. So this is just dpv. Which is equal to the same thing on the right-hand side. And we can use the various thermodynamic relations. In particular, there's the integrability condition. And what the integrability condition is yes?
Is it PV or rho v?
Oh, it's rho v, sorry. That's right. It's the energy density times the volume. The integrability condition is basically saying that the universe is expanding adiabatically, meaning the expansion is slow relative to all the thermal processes, which is, of course, true according to our basic assumption about equilibrium. And this is equivalent to saying that this differential is exact, meaning that the way that I can write this is always, you know, one variable is a function, and it's a function of two other variables. And that if I take the derivatives of those two variables, it shouldn't matter which order I take the derivatives in. So this condition is essentially equivalent to if I take, say, S as a function of T and V, that if I take my derivative of a function of T holding V fixed and V holding T fixed is the same as the derivative of V holding T fixed and T holding V fixed. So imposing this condition, which hopefully is recognizable from a thermo course that you took at some point, you can write the entropy as d rho plus p over t times v plus a constant. It's just a few lines of algebra if you want to try it yourself. Okay, so we immediately see that this is basically the definition of our entropy in a very general sense. We can then take the continuity equation, which we wrote up, where do we write it? Up here, rho dot is 3h rho plus p equals 0. So this is something that we just derived from our metric. And when we plug that in, we find that everything in here cancels. So what we get is ds is 0. So using just basic thermodynamic definitions along with one of the equations that we get for the expansion of the universe, we get this expression that entropy is conserved by the expansion of the universe. And this turns out to be a very important thing that we'll use later on. So in particular, we can define entropy as p plus rho a cubed over t, and this is conserved. So what's nice about this is that we now have something that we know does not change with the scale factor. And so this allows us to relate the thermodynamic quantities to the scale factor. Okay. So the way that we can do this is by defining the entropy density. I don't know what's the best way to do it. I'll put it over here. The entropy density is little s, which is going to be big S divided by the volume. And this is just big S over a cubed. And then this is just going to be p plus rho over t. Now, what's really important about this is that little s is something that does not change with scale factor over a cubed. So it is always true, if entropy is conserved, that s is some constant over a cubed. And so we have this thing here, which is a function of temperature, and we know exactly how it scales with the scale factor. So we can plug in our expressions for rho. So we know that rho up at the top is this function of t to the fourth. P is just going to be a third of rho from our equation of motion, and so we can just immediately write down what this entropy density is. This entropy density is some prefactor g star s t gamma cubed. I should note that when I don't specify what t it is, it's always the temperature of the photon. Okay. So we're basically playing the same trick as we did with the energy density, which is that this rho and p are a sum over a lot of different species, and we're sort of collapsing it all into one expression. So this g star s has a similar form as g star, and usually the values are very similar. Okay. So this is the sum over bosons of gi Ti over T cubed, and then this theta function, plus the same sum over fermions, 7 over 8 Gi Ti over T gamma cubed. So I can now immediately just write down how the temperature scales with the scale factor. If g star s is constant, then I see that T gamma goes like S to the third, and S goes like A to the minus 3. So I immediately get that T is proportional to 1 over A. So this is just the simplest thing that you can imagine, that as the universe expands by a factor of 2, the temperature gets cut by a factor of 2. And this is the last missing link, because now that we have this, we can determine all of the abundances as a function of the scale factor. And so now I have a complete thermal history of my theory as a function of temperature. Also, just for completeness, I'm going to write down the version of, let's see, where is it? Up there, we have the Hubble constant as a function of A. So I can now write Hubble as a function of A as a function of temperature. And so this gives me the expansion rate as a function of temperature. So since Hubble is 1 over 2t, and t goes like, A goes like square root of t, I can show that this has the form 1.66. This 1.66 is just some of the numerical factors evaluated. T squared over m Planck. And so this is the more used version of the link between the expansion rate and the temperature. Okay. Are there any questions about this?
So this is just for radiation dominated.
It's just for radiation dominated. But like I said, pretty much everything we do is going to be for radiation dominated. So maybe a better way of putting this is that this is always true as long as you're at early enough times.
So which is like before CMB, when decoupled, or
pardon me?
Like what time?
So matter radiation quality is around the time of the CMB. So it's good basically right down to the CMB. But what's nice about this conservation of entropy is that we did not actually have to assume that the universe was radiation dominated. So this entropy conservation requirement is always. So even once the universe transitions, you still have this scaling of entropy with the scale factor. Yeah.
So is this like just the second law of thermodynamics for closed systems, or?
That's right. Yeah, this is just the second law applied to the expanding universe, which is taken to be closed. Co-moving volume. That's right. So actually, in relation to your last point, there's one last thing that I want to write down. And I see that I'm running out of board space, so I'll just, what should I erase? So the last thing that's handy is that S, regardless of whether it's radiation or matter dominated, has a well-defined scaling. Basically, it goes like A to the minus 3. So if we want to remove the effects of scaling from a system, we can divide by the entropy density. So for example, if I have some abundance I, it can change from two ways. One is from dilution, or the expansion, just that it's a number density, and the space is getting bigger, so the density gets smaller. But it can also be, say, from a Boltzmann factor, or it could be from something else. So what we want, in principle, to do is separate out the effects of the expansion from everything else. And so what we can do is define what's called the yield y, which is just the number density divided by the entropy density. And it has the nice property that at early times, s goes like t cubed and n goes like t cubed. So this is just a constant. Then as you approach, so let's say this is 1 over the temperature. As you approach temperatures that are equal to the mass, you start having this exponential fall off. So what you see is in the relativistic phase, you have something that is not changing with temperature. And then in the non-relativistic phase, it is changing with temperature. So this yield is a very handy way of sort of modding out the effects of the expanding universe. And what we'll see is that because as long as entropy is conserved, This allows you to track the expansion all the way down to very early times. So, sorry, not early times, late times. So just for reference, the entropy today is about 2,000 photons per inverse centimeter cubed. And so if I know the yield today and I know the entropy today, I can determine the number density at all times, at earlier times. So this is a very powerful thing, and we'll see over the next few days like how it's used in more general systems. So okay, we're out of time. Feel free to ask me questions if you have them. Otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow. Oh, and I should like to point out that this lecture is probably the most in terms of like bombarding you with results that you'll need for the rest of the class. So from now on, we'll do more physics and less just kind of writing down results.